Hello and welcome to Asia Stream, where we track, report, and analyze the issues and interests of the world's largest region. I am Waj Khan, Nikkei's digital editor, here in New York City. Today's episode, the Olympics according to Xi. Beijing has become the first city in the world to host both the Summer and Winter Olympics. The Summer Games were hosted in the Chinese capital in 2008. Though just 14 years ago, they seem a lifetime away. President George W. Bush attended the opening. Protests over Tibetan human rights made things complicated politically for Beijing, but didn't derail the competition. Indeed, the 2008 Games were China's coming out party on the global scene. But these ongoing Winter Games are different. Underway is a diplomatic boycott led by America. Human rights violations by Beijing against the Uyghur Muslims, the people of Hong Kong, and others loom in the background, as does China's recent conflict with India, threats to Taiwan, and security and trade tensions with the US and Australia. The games, though going smoothly, are being conducted under tightly controlled conditions. Athletes have a gag order. They can't say anything against the Chinese state or they will be punished. Social and mainstream media are severely restricted. And critically, the whole exercise is being conducted under a very strict and very controversial zero-COVID umbrella. More scandals fester. Though tennis isn't a part of these games, the disappearance and reappearance of Chinese tennis star Peng Shui remains a question for global sports bodies. Shui made allegations last year against a senior Communist Party official for sexual misconduct, but has since mysteriously claimed otherwise. There are more routine hiccups as well, like doping scandals and low TV ratings. And despite the bubble, star athletes are testing positive for COVID. But behind it all, looming larger than the games, the medals, the boycotts and the drama, is one man, Xi Jinping. Since assuming office almost a decade ago, China's 68-year-old leader has amassed immense power and a formidable reputation. At home, he's crushed his political opponents, reined in big business, and claims to have quashed corruption. But abroad, he's ditched China's decades-old policy of laying low. His wolf warrior diplomacy is muscular and confrontational. His trade tariff wars have destroyed competitors, and his Belt and Road Initiative has created a roster of indebted client states. Meanwhile, his military buildup has modernized China's armed forces like never before. The People's Liberation Army Navy is now the biggest in the world. The Chinese Air Force regularly breaches Taiwan's air defense zones, and its ground forces incursions almost triggered an all-out ground war with India in 2020. In fact, Xi's cyber regime is so intrusive that it has not only prompted new legislation in global capitals against surveillance and Chinese tech companies, but also recently forced the FBI to warn Olympic athletes to leave their phones at home. And yet, Xi Jinping is hosting the Olympics, the games dedicated to driving athletes to be sitius, altius, fortius, faster, higher, stronger, maybe because that's what Xi wants to do. But is Xi Jinping playing in the spirit of the Olympics or playing to win? That and more is coming up. On your marks and get set for a hell of a show. You're listening to The Sound of Asia, streaming in your ear. From Nikkei Asia, this is Asia Stream. Now, joining me to kick off the conversation are Asia Stream correspondents Monica Hunter-Hart and Jack Stone-Truett. Monica and Jack, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Wash.
Happy to be here.
All right, Jack, let's start with you. So going into these games, much was made of the possibility of a total boycott from various countries over China's human rights violations against the Uyghurs in the Xinjiang region and the tangential issues like Hong Kong, etc. But of course, that did not happen. Rather, there has been this so-called diplomatic boycott. Now, what exactly is happening on that end?
So a diplomatic boycott is kind of like a boycott light. It was declared by the U.S. and nine other mostly Western countries, and it just means that their athletes are participating, but no officials or ministers were in attendance during the opening ceremony as they typically are.
The Biden administration will not send any diplomatic or official representation to the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics and Paralympic Games, given the PRC's ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang and other human rights abuses.
And did this display of diplomatic disapproval from Western countries create a big splash?
Well, it's always hard to gauge the effect of these sorts of things, right? Mm. Unsurprisingly, Chinese state media claimed that America's efforts to thwart the games were a failure. And though the lack of any official U.S. presence was notable, frankly, there were enough major leaders attending that it certainly hasn't felt like the world has been on any sort of diplomatic strike against the games.
Yeah, 22 world leaders were there, including Vladimir Putin, who's currently in the news for Russia's military buildup on the Ukrainian border, as well as Pakistan's Imran Khan and leaders from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the UAE.
Ah, the Democracy Forever Club.
Right. The UN Secretary General and the head of the WHO were also in attendance.
Right. Okay, so, but does it matter, Jack, whether or not the president or a prime minister or a king or a queen end up attending the big show of the opening ceremony? I mean, they can always cast the fun and games on TV, right? Surely you don't fly all the way to Beijing just for the fireworks. There's a higher purpose here.
If you're a foreign leader, the ability to visit Beijing means a great deal. Xi Jinping hasn't left mainland China since the pandemic began over 2 years ago. So being able to hold numerous face-to-face meetings with foreign leaders like this was a big opportunity for everyone involved. Mm. The meeting with Putin was the big headline, considering the crisis in Ukraine, but a number of neighboring Central Asian countries like Turkmenistan and Tajikistan, as well as Serbia and Poland, all met with Xi and agreed to new economic or trade deals. FaceTime like this after 2 years of virtual diplomacy with one of the most powerful men in the world is invaluable, especially at a moment like this, as many countries look to leverage China against the U.S. and vice versa.
Right, that's interesting. So there's this abstract geopolitical competition of sorts going on in parallel to the games, but let's not lose sight of the friendlier competition taking place as well. Monica, talk to me about the games themselves. How's China doing so far?
Actually, China is excelling so far.
What does actually mean? That's a big, big qualifier there. What does it mean?
Well, China has always performed really well in the summer games, but it's never been a winter sports powerhouse. It's competed in every Winter Olympics since 1980, but it didn't even win a gold medal there until 2002.
Yeah, I'll give you that, because every time I think of China at the Olympics, I think gymnastics, I think weightlifting, I think diving, sports like that.
Exactly. But they've already won 3 gold medals as of Thursday. Huh. In the last Winter Games, by comparison, they only got 1 the entire time. Wow. Now, of course, every country cares about winning medals, but China has perfected quite a system to make sure it does so. It scouts athletes as kids and sends them for full-time training at over 2,000 government schools around the country. It tends to focus on sports that are underfunded in the West to give it an edge.
That's quite strategic. So what's China winning at this time?
So far, it's won 2 golds in speed skating and 1 in freestyle skiing.
It should be said that China's still behind 6 other countries in gold medals overall. As of Thursday, leading the pack is Germany with 6 golds so far, followed by Norway with 5.
True, but in the Olympics, according to Xi, both he and China are looking pretty impressive right now.
Right. Well, I'm pretty sure he's quite happy with the way things are going with his smoothly running Olympics machine. But any particularly notable moments that we should be aware of?
Definitely some notable moments in the game so far. Particularly, the biggest story is still unfolding, it seems, but Russia's 15-year-old figure skating phenom, Kamila Valieva, has reportedly failed a drug test. There was also quite a stir around the Japanese figure skater Yuzuru Hanyu.
Yeah, so Yuzu, I think they call him. He's huge, and I know we did a story earlier in the week about how he's Japanese, but he's got this huge following in China, which has like transcended political tensions between Tokyo and Beijing.
It's true. Yes, he has quite a fandom in China. Yuzu won golds for figure skating in both of the last 2 Winter Games, but this time he made several mistakes on the ice, maybe most notably on Thursday when he fell twice. He was attempting a comeback by landing a quadruple axel, which has never yet been done in competition.
This jump, the quad axel.
Whoa, he got so close. That was pretty rotated.
It was an ambitious routine and still an impressive finish to what might be the end of his Olympics career.
The new man on top is Nathan Chen from Team USA. He's a Chinese-American athlete from Utah, and he's just set a world record in his short program and nabbed the gold in the men's individual competition.
The reaction from the crowd, that is the highest number that we have ever seen in a short program. Nearly 114.
There are still 10 days to go before the games end, so I'm sure we can expect many more upsets and memorable victories before then.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to it and hope both of you stay off the ice. I appreciate you coming in.
Sure thing.
Thanks, Wash.
Thanks again, Jack and Monica. Now, let's dive deeper into the world of the man himself, Xi Jinping, and how these Olympics factor into his broader political agenda. Here to discuss that is Professor Kerry Brown, a former British diplomat and director of the China Lao Institute at King's College London, and author of numerous books on the country, including one on Xi Jinping himself. Kerry, thank you for joining Asia Stream.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. So, Professor, in 2018, you wrote a book titled The World According to Xi. So, simply, how has the world, according to Xi, changed in the 4 years since?
I think the fundamental mission has stayed the same, which is to make China great again, to make it a hugely powerful and important country. Of course, the environment has totally changed because of the pandemic. I think China's relations with the outside world, particularly the US, have become much sharper. And I think it's a much tougher diplomatic kind of story that China's trying to tell now, because it's got an audience in Europe and America which is more skeptical and probably more hostile to it.
Right. Now, based on that, Professor, I want to do a quick compare and contrast exercise of these ongoing Olympics with the 2008 Summer Games, which were also held in Beijing. The Olympics are, of course, as we all know, an opportunity for a country to showcase itself to the world and to send a message about its culture, its values, its economic weight and might. But what is China trying to convey about itself in these ongoing Winter Games compared to what it was trying to convey about itself with the 2008 Games?
I think 2008 was a really epochal kind of event because it was the first time China had hosted any major event like this. And I think there was still a little bit of naivety on both sides. I think for China, it felt it would gain the affection of the outside world, and it didn't really expect so much criticism to come its way that year because of uprising in Tibet and other, you know, human rights issues.
Pro-Tibet supporters scaled the Eiffel Tower, France's most famous landmark, despite huge security.
We want stop genocide in Tibet. We want complete independence. No Olympics in China until Tibet is free.
We are here under counter-demonstration against Chinese Olympic torch, which is a torch of shame, crime, blood.
This time, it's much more knowledgeable about what the West thinks about it. And I think, you know, the diplomatic boycott of the Games has created this sense that this is really an Olympics for China, for its domestic audience and for its alliance system.
Now, Professor, you've said that the 2008 Games changed China, in part because it was forced to do some soul-searching about its image after critiques, as you've mentioned, about human rights abuses, etc. So are the 2022 Games expected to change China?
I don't think it will. I mean, it's confirmed some things. It's confirmed the divisions. It's confirmed the diplomatic coldness between particularly the United States and China. I don't think it's going to, you know, change China's tack. I think it's just a moment for China to try and say to itself and its alliances that, you know, despite COVID, it's now standing up again. It's trying to function again. It's made it through. And, you know, business as normal will be resumed as soon as possible.
Right. So, Professor, so many items appear on the Watch Out for China radar in the human rights cockpit, if you can call it that. But let's focus on the Uyghurs for a quick minute. Now, China's treatment of this ethnic minority has caused many countries, including the US, to diplomatically boycott the Games. So
Does this boycott stand a chance of compelling China to change its behavior towards the Uyghurs?
There is no evidence that China's going to change its mind on this. It seems that many of the camps that had been established are no longer functioning, and so things have changed in Xinjiang, though it's hard to tell because it's very difficult to get access there. The diplomatic boycott is really more about the West feeling it needs to do something for itself. I don't know whether this kind of boycott is going to be effective, because of course the sports people still win, and you know, the games go on. In a sense, it's a victory for China that that's happened, and so I think that we have to think hard about, okay, the West can certainly be very angry about this issue and concerned about it, but that doesn't mean that what it's doing is effective.
Right. So, Professor, if the Olympics continue on this seemingly stable, successful trajectory, are they going to be considered a sort of a coronation pre-party for President Xi before he seeks his third term this fall? Or could something backfire for Xi between now and October when he gets coronated, so to say?
I mean, I think his coronation has been prepared for the last 5 years. I mean, this is the Olympics is one step of many, which will feed into this narrative of Xi Jinping's leadership being good for China, strong, stable, all of these stories. What we've got to remember is that if it doesn't work out for Xi, there isn't an alternative. There's no leaders around him at the moment who could easily step into his shoes without a lot of infighting and instability. The question really is, will we see in November or October leaders appointed at the same time who possibly five, you know, or more years down the line could be successors? Because he's 70 next year, you know, I mean, he's getting older. There's got to be some kind of succession plan. Formal positions on the whole have not been held by people older than their mid-70s or early-70s. And, you know, I mean, this is really kind of an institutional thing, is it, that the party is saying in the future it wants, you know, leaders who can just go on and on and on. And I mean, that's probably not a great precedent, because although Xi Jinping is competent, clearly politically very competent, even though the West doesn't particularly like him, but I mean, they don't like him probably because he's competent. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a successor who is going to be similarly competent. Systems can produce extremely incompetent leaders, as we see in Europe all the time and in America. So a competent autocrat is one thing, an incompetent autocrat is completely another thing.
So, Professor, it seems these games are only further solidifying the pro-China and anti-China camps that divide so many countries right now. I'm curious how you see the goals of the players who are hostile to China, though. For example, right now the Quad, the alliance between the US, Australia, India and Japan, is having meetings down under. So what is the anti-China camp aiming for concurrently as the games continue and moving forward as well?
Well, this is part of a long, long story, and it's going to take many, many years to work out. I mean, the Americans have created a new set of alliances because of the Quad, as you say, also because of AUKUS, you know, the Australia-UK United States treaty signed last September, creating this idea of the Indo-Pacific. So it's like a kind of Asia without China in it. Good luck with that. Trying to work more closely with India. I mean, yeah, this is all very valuable and worth doing. But the point is that you are not able to easily avoid the very, very clear fact that China is a fifth of humanity, a fifth of global GDP. It is crucial for solving issues like climate change, pandemics, even though it's got a contentious issue, you know, around the current one. In the future, it's likely China will be an ally in these issues. This is a complicated story. There are no easy boundaries.
Right. And finally, Professor, before I let you go, in 2015, you called Xi Jinping China's CEO. So here we are in 2022, in the second week, or almost the second week of the Olympic Games. Will your job title for him now change? Is he now Emperor Xi, or General Xi, or El Comandante Xi, or Big Brother Forever Xi versus CEO?
Well, I mean, I think he's in charge of an enormously economically productive enterprise. And, you know, in global politics, like in, you know, kind of politics domestically, you follow the money. And as long as China is a viable business in terms of producing large amounts of growth, then, you know, it's going to be a significant and powerful force. And I think that the world is going to have to make some sharp choices about how they deal with that. But it's not going to get easier. Xi Jinping, you know, the worst thing we can do is to kind of not take Xi Jinping seriously. He is a formidable politician. He may be formidably unlikable for some people, but he's a formidable politician. And unless we accept that, we're not going to be able to work very carefully or well in order to deal with some of the challenges he throws up.
Professor Kerry Brown from King's College. Thank you, sir. And I hope you're staying safe and dry in London.
I am. Thank you very much.
Now, let's zoom in a bit more onto Xi's plans to make these Olympics a success. The cornerstone of his plans for the Games has been his zero COVID policy, which he's had for a while, but which has taken on an even greater urgency for these Games as the world looks on. Here to talk to us about Xi's COVID tactics is CK Tan. Our chief Shanghai correspondent was recently in Beijing to cover the Games. CK, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
All right, now CK, let's start off with the basics. Why is China's zero COVID strategy often preceded or followed by a now familiar adjective, controversial?
Well, we have been living with COVID for the past 2 years or more than 2 years now. And right from the beginning, the government has this policy.
Simply put, the goal is to have no COVID cases at all. Now that's led to some of the harshest travel restrictions and lockdowns anywhere.
Since late December, 13 million people in the city of Xi'an have been ordered to stay home.
400 buses carrying 9,000 people to isolation zones in the last days.
Each time when there is an outbreak in China, authorities will immediately go down to the affected areas and they will lock down the affected areas or even the city. So in the case of, in the most recent case was in Xi'an, which is in slightly western central China. It's a city of about 13 million population. And why is it controversial is perhaps I think it's the measures or the way they locked down the whole city. When we say lockdown in China here, it means that you have zero movement. You are not allowed to leave your home unless for you know, the essentials. The essentials are basically, you know, each household is allowed to go out maybe perhaps twice a week to do their necessary shopping, grocery shopping. And that's it. And even during that that short period of freedom, I mean, the time that they leave their homes will be recorded. So this is one thing. And in the case of Xi'an, we could see how the system, the lockdown system, broke down in a way that we heard that some residents were not allowed to go out. And we also heard of a very unfortunate case of a 8-month pregnant lady who was about to go into the labor, but she wasn't admitted or she wasn't allowed to be admitted into the hospital. And unfortunately, she lost her baby. And this really created a big news on the social media here in China.
Yes, that's a devastatingly sad story. And those are tough measures by any standard. But coming back, CK, to the political dynamics of the zero COVID strategy. So in Urdu, there's a famous saying that you can't use a cannon to kill a mosquito. Of course, I don't want to call the pandemic a mosquito or belittle the millions of people who've lost their lives in it, but considering that a city of millions is locked down by just a few cases, is this perhaps an instance of that saying in action, that the authorities are using a cannon to kill a mosquito?
Yeah, to a certain extent, I think that is true. And strangely for us, you know, living in China, the COVID measures appears to differ from city to city. So in the case of what I've just described in Xi'an, or even before that in Wuhan, and in other smaller cities, we have seen really, really tough measures. But compared to that, you know, we have outbreaks in Shanghai, we have outbreaks in big cities like Beijing, but we did not see, you know, the total lockdown of the entire city.
Well, speaking of big cities, CK, you just got back from Beijing, and I know you weren't able to enter some of those Olympics facilities you were covering because access is so tightly controlled. But still, it would be great to get a sense from you about what the mood on the ground is like. From what I understand, the Olympics are supposed to be very festive, very dynamic, a very, very colorful event. So paint us a picture of Beijing during the Olympics, yet under this zero COVID cloud.
The mood in Beijing was unexpectedly quiet. And along the main street of Beijing, for about 4 to 5 kilometers along the whole street, you would see policemen or special forces officers standing every 100 meters apart, 24 hours. So security was very, very strict. Although there were a lot of billboards, posters promoting the Olympics, but you hardly see any local on the streets. I did not really feel the kind of, you know, cheering mood for the Olympics here.
So CK, quickly, before I let you go, is there some sort of a connection between the way President Xi has conducted these Olympics and the way he is trying to maneuver himself into a position for a third term?
Yeah, I think President Xi has strategically used the Olympics to boost, one, number one, his image, his international diplomacy strategy. And number two, this could pave way for his bid for the third term in the National Congress meeting in the fall. So domestically, he could tell the audience here that, you know, look, you know, how well we have conducted the Olympics despite all the challenges of COVID and the pandemic. And look, you know, there were some boycotts from the West, but look, you know, we have Vladimir Putin here, and as well as some other leaders from the Central Asia, some parts of Asia and Latin America.
Right, so he could use that to tell the Chinese people that it was a huge success. Do you think they will buy that? Will these games actually increase Xi's popularity?
Yeah, I think we could safely assume that, you know, the Olympics would be a huge success, and it would be a huge boost to his image.
Got it. CK Tan, our Shanghai correspondent. Thanks for being on Asia Stream, CK, and we must have you on again. Stay safe.
Thank you, Rich.
Thanks to CK Tan and Kerry Brown for joining us today. That's it for Asia Stream this week. As always, I encourage you to head to Nikkei Asia at asia.nikkei.com for more in-depth coverage of the Olympics, China, and of course, the rest of Asia. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share, subscribe, and leave us a review and hopefully a 5-star rating. And a reminder that Nikkei Asia is currently offering an exclusive discount for our podcast listeners. Just type in the code ASIASTREAM, all caps, no spaces, at checkout when you visit asia.nikkei.com. This episode was produced by Monica Hunter-Hart and Jack Stone-Truitt. I'm your host, Waj Khan. Let's cross streams next week.